admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Good morning, all. The case originally scheduled for argument, Cape and Sons versus Strew Construction, has been vacated, and the first case for argument then this morning is J.P. Morgan and Company versus CRIS. Mr. Schiffman.
Thank you, Your Honor. The two most important aspects of this case are what the government has not said. First, the government has not appealed from the decision below that its own method of accounting failed the statutory test. The IRS method did not clearly reflect income. Second, the government has never disagreed with the central argument that we have made on appeal, which is that in a method of accounting case, the court's role is limited to choosing between the two methods of accounting proposed by the parties. The court has no authority to devise its own method of accounting. The government doesn't quarrel with that principle. It never claims that the court has the authority to come up with its own different method. Those two concessions, we think, require a reversal of this case. If the government's own method fails the test, and if the court has no authority to prescribe its own different method, then that what that leaves you with is the method of accounting that the taxpayer used.
The government keeps insisting that the commissioner agreed with them. I'm sorry, that the tax court agreed with the commissioner.
The government's method of accounting was mid-market values with no adjustments. The court said three different times that that method fails to reflect income clearly and therefore fails the statutory test. Now, what the government did do was come up with a lot of criticisms of our method, which the court accepted. But it's one thing to say that the court agrees with criticisms of the taxpayer's method. It's quite another thing to say that the court agreed with the government's different method. The court most clearly did not. The court said that in order to reflect income clearly, there must be adjustments for administrative costs and credit risk. The government, from start to finish of this case, said its method of accounting was no adjustments for credit risks or administrative costs. And that's why the court repeatedly found that the government's method of accounting did not clearly reflect income.
Well, when you say there's no adjustments, when did the government come up and think that these adjustments just be wrong on your part, but that they would go along with certain types of adjustments, netting and that sort of thing?
The government never came forward with a method of accounting that implemented netting.
Is there one now?
The court ordered the parties to prepare computations in accordance with its own method of accounting and enter judgment on that basis.
This is 15 years ago.
That's right.
Is there presently a formula for swaps?
The government has even to this day, the government has never said that the judge got it right.
No, but has the IRS in the subsequent years, Mr. Schiffman, issued a reg that would speak to this issue?
The government last year issued a proposed regulation. The proposed regulation, for the most part, says that if a taxpayer uses fair value accounting that's consistent with generally accepted accounting principles, that will satisfy the statute. Now, it added some additional requirements, but that regulation even now has not taken effect and is radically different from the decision that we got in this case.
Well, that's more fair value in FASB is what you advocate, isn't it?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
Well, and they're not back. You say the government is no longer pushing fair market value with, I guess, no adjustments, as you say?
The proposed regulation says that in general, if the taxpayer is consistent with fair value under FASB, that will be adequate to come up with fair market value under Section 475.
So they're
a lot closer to our position than they were to the judge's position, which said that you have to satisfy these nine specific requirements in order to come within the statute. Those nine requirements certainly during the years in question, and maybe even today, could not be satisfied by any swap dealer in the United States. For example, one of the judge's requirements, one thing he insisted upon in order to conclude that a method of accounting would reflect income clearly, is what he called a bilateral credit adjustment that takes into account the taxpayer's own credit rating. At the time, during the tax years at issue in this case, no one was doing this. There had never been an academic paper saying that you should do this. The first time that any dealer in the United States, so far as we can tell, ever did this was in 1997, 4 years after the years at issue in this case. And the court's own expert in the trial in 2001 still only knew of one dealer in the country who was doing that.
Was using the bilateral formula?
Yes, yes. Now, the court, perhaps understandably, decided to agree with the expert that it appointed, saying that bilateral was correct. But that's an area of considerable controversy. Almost everybody is on the other side. We explain in our brief why we think it's the right method, and it's the only method consistent with 475. But our fundamental point is that the clear reflection of income standard in 475 in 446 is not intended to require taxpayers to use the very, very best accounting method.
Well, I think you can understand, it's my problem, and I think our problem is the time and effort that has been put into this case. It's phenomenal. And we get a 20-minute argument, and we're supposed to figure out something that you guys have been working on for over a year, or maybe, I don't want to go too far back. What are we supposed to do?
There are two holdings that I would like the court to make. The first holding is that under Section 446, a taxpayer can prevail in a method of accounting case in either of two ways, either by showing that its method clearly reflects income or by showing that the government's method does not. That's what the Eighth Circuit said. That's what the Tenth Circuit said. That's what two tax court judges have said. And the government hasn't appealed from the fact that we met that burden of proof. We showed that the government's method of accounting did not clearly reflect income. And therefore, under the Eighth Circuit and Tenth Circuit approaches, and we think under the clear language of 446, we prevail.
Well, why shouldn't we rely on that All Steel Equipment case, which several courts have agreed with, that have held that the tax court may reject the taxpayer's method of accounting even if the tax court does not adapt every aspect of the commissioner's method? And isn't that the situation here, that it was adopted, but it was tweaked by the tax court? There were just some minor adjustments. Why isn't that reasonable?
Well, first of all, in the All Steel case, the tax court expressly found that the government's method of accounting did clearly reflect income. There was a choice in that case between two methods. One was called prime cost, and the other was called full absorption. And the details don't matter, but the tax court found that the taxpayer's method did not comply with GAAP and was not did not clearly reflect income.
But in that case, didn't the court also reject certain aspects of the services method?
That didn't actually happen. What happened was that during the course of the trial, the service admitted that it had made errors in filling out the return. The service admitted that and agreed to make those changes. And the court said, fine, you've made those changes, you fixed up the problem, and you've got the valid method. The court never changed the method of the tax that the IRS had proposed. The court said the method was right. The IRS had made some errors in applying that method. It fixed up those errors, and therefore what it did was correct.
Mr. Shipman, as the inherent power of the tax court in this area, are you suggesting this is close to an arbitration situation? You pick A or B, but that's all you can do. You don't have any room?
On methods of accounting, that's absolutely right. That's what 446 calls for. 446A has a general rule, and it has exceptions. The general rule does not require a clear reflection of income. So the tax court was just plainly wrong in saying that he had to come up with a method of accounting that clearly reflects income. The general rule requires only one thing, which is book tax conformity. Use the same methods of accounting on the tax return that you use in your financial statement. Now, subsection B is the exceptions. And subsection B gives the secretary or the commissioner the discretion to choose a different method of accounting. Doesn't give the court any discretion. Only the secretary can pick something different. But only if two conditions are satisfied. First, that the taxpayer's method does not clearly reflect income. And second, that the commissioner's method does clearly reflect income. And the commissioner just failed that test, the court said. The commissioner said no adjustments in this case for credit or administrative costs, and the court said that's wrong. You can't do it. You won't clearly reflect income if you do. Now, the second issue, which I want to address, again, a legal issue, goes to the court's conclusion that our method of accounting did not clearly reflect income. We are asking this court to hold as a matter of law that a method of accounting under 475 will clearly reflect income if two conditions are satisfied. First, the taxpayer's method of accounting is consistent with generally accepted accounting principles. And second, that those GAAP accounting principles are consistent with the code and with the regulations. Now, the IRS has said in its brief, in bold-faced type, that GAAP compliance is irrelevant. Well, that's not what this court said in the American Fletcher case, and it's not what the Treasury Department says in the regulations under this very statute. The regulations say that a method of accounting that is consistent with generally accepted accounting principles will ordinarily be deemed to clearly reflect income. So ordinarily, GAAP is enough. That means you need some extraordinary reason to say that a GAAP method does not satisfy the statute. Now, we argued in our brief that the only time the courts have ever found that a GAAP method did not clearly reflect income are where somebody could point to a specific provision in the code or a specific regulation that mandates a different method of accounting. The government cannot point to any case where a GAAP method was rejected except where the code or a regulation specifies something different. That's why the regulation says that ordinarily if you satisfy GAAP, that's good enough under the statute.
What's been going on since this time? Maybe are swaps, for all these years, have swaps been continuing? Is it continuing financial security? Is this?
The market is exploding. It grows year after year.
How many of these cases are out there?
I don't know how many.
Is everybody doing it right now?
There have not been any decided cases other than this one.
Are there other challenges?
Lots of other challenges. I assume many of the cases have been settled.
Is this going to be a precedent to apply to all these others that are pending?
I sure hope not, but I think it's going to be trumped by the regulation.
If it goes in your favor, you would hope so, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how this goes on and on with this kind of expense, frankly.
That's why I think that the baseball arbitration approach spelled out in the statute makes sense, which is the judge's job is just to choose between the two methods before him or her and not to select, try to come up with something that's better.
Yeah, but we have a specialized court here, right? Baseball arbitration isn't necessarily... doesn't bring to bear the same legal expertise, does it, Mr. Shipman?
Well, tax cases usually go to the tax court. Sometimes they go to the district court. No judge before this case has ever dealt with this issue, and hopefully if this case is resolved correctly, no judge will ever have to look at it again. And, in fact, if the proposed regulations become final, and there's a general deference to compliance with GAAP.
It's incredible that it's taken this long on the regulations, but maybe Ms. Hagley can give us some insight into the dispatch with which the IRS is addressing this issue. But I share my brother's observation about the state of this area of the law.
Well, that's why we're asking the court to enter a clear rule. Compliance with GAAP, if GAAP is consistent with the statute, is enough. And why did the Treasury Department adopt a regulation saying that compliance with GAAP will ordinarily be deemed to clearly reflect income? Well, first, that's the thrust of 446A, which says use the same method on the books as you use on your tax return, that what you use on your books, which is generally GAAP, is good enough. Second, it's also in keeping with subsection B, because the goal of generally accepted accounting principles is exactly the same as the goal of 446B, to clearly reflect income. And especially in the case of swap dealers, almost all of whom are public companies, they're very powerful forces to make sure that they use sound accounting methods. And that's because not only is their accounting reviewed by outside auditors to ensure compliance with GAAP, but their financial statements are put in their securities filings, and if they report income incorrectly, they're likely to be sued. They're likely to be sued if the numbers are too high. They're likely to be sued if the numbers are too low. So there are powerful forces at work to ensure that what you put on your financial statements accurately reflects your income. And 446A says that if you use the same methods on your tax return that you used on your financial statements, that those are good enough.
But those are market forces, and it seems that what, I don't know, maybe that the government's looking for or trying to, is to have a formula that is consistent. And when you get into the netting and dynamic and bilateral creditworthiness, there's a lot of variables in there that would seem maybe market forces are the only thing that really do determine the true value as opposed to some formula.
Well, the formula that the government advocated in this case was wrong, because that formula said forget about your administrative costs and forget about your credit risk. And that's what the judge said, and the government hasn't appealed from that. Now, the judge came up with his own formula, and you know, if anything shows the problems with that formula, it is the fact that it took the government more than a year to do the calculations called for by the judge for this one taxpayer. This one taxpayer had 1,000 swaps.
That's there why I'm wondering what's going on with all the others.
I think we're moving toward the proposed regulation, which is GAAP is good enough, generally speaking. And the IRS is not going to try to come up with its own different formula for this very difficult problem of determining the fair market value of over-the-counter swap transactions.
Of course, we also have here the Rule 155 computation, which you say they just adopted the tax court just after 150-page opinion and went to the computation and just adopted the commissioner's.
Yes, that's another problem we have in the decision, is that the tax court just rubber-stamped. We had an $11 million dispute. The judge didn't say one word about that. He just said, we agree with the government, and that does not comply with the statute.
And, of course, our problem is there's no line-by-line discussion about what's right and what's wrong with each computation. Are there 59 swaps? I think in your brief you said something about 59 swaps that are at issue here.
The judge entered an order saying, after the parties had submitted their computations and we said there should be credit adjustments on 59 swaps, he agreed there should be credit adjustments on 59 swaps. Then he told the parties to submit new computations. They did. And the IRS said, no, we think there should only be credit adjustments on, I think the number was 30 swaps. And he said, now I agree with the IRS. Now, you know, there's no explanation for why he flipped from one to the other. That's not the focus of our argument. The focus of our argument is that he should have accepted the taxpayer's method of accounting first, because the government's method was failed the statutory test, and second, because our method complied with GAAP, and the GAAP method was consistent with the code and the regulations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hilton. Ms. Hagley?
Good morning. May it please the Court. First of all, I'd like to respond to counsel's position. The government hasn't taken position on whether it should be baseball arbitration. What we've said in our brief is that, no, that is not the case. If there's a specific method of accounting set out in the code, as there is here in 475, the tax court has the power to interpret to interpret that provision, and it's not making tax policy, as counsel argues. And in support of that, we cite the consolidated manufacturing case, which also involved a specific method of accounting. It was one that was set out in a reg. And in that case, the court rejected the taxpayer's method and said it didn't clearly reflect income. This is a method for determining market price under a reg. Also rejected the commissioner's finding that the commissioner's method of determining market price did not clearly reflect income, and remanded to the tax court to make the determination of applying that regulation and coming up with the market price. So in addition to the tax court having the power to interpret a specific method of accounting, the tax court also has the power to correct a method of accounting of the commissioners so that it does clearly reflect income. We think that's what happened in the Allstill case, as well as the Second Circuit's Caldwell case, and what happened here. The tax court in Allstill said that it could discern the general approach taken by the commissioner, and that inclusion of erroneous items, both those conceded by the commissioner and those found by the tax court, does not render the commissioner's general approach arbitrary. And that's what happened here. The tax court was able to discern the commissioner's general approach, which was denying or rejecting the deferral accounting and requiring market-to-market accounting that was consistent with 475, and then corrected the commissioner's application of the 475 valuation method. It's been our position since day one that mid-market values can be adjusted for both credit risk and administrative expenses, but that this taxpayer on these facts was not entitled to any further adjustments. Cite as an example our brief and answer, which was docket number 168. If you look at pages 150 to 151, you'll see where we clearly say that from day one, that has been our position.
What are the adjustments that he used that were not appropriate?
We said that you could have adjustments, and we set out the valuation method. We list in our brief the 10 different aspects of what a proper valuation method would be under 475, all adopted by the court. But we also said that you would need to verify those valuation adjustments against market benchmarks. The court disagreed with that aspect of our valuation methodology. But otherwise, it did embrace it. And I do think the court did just tweak what was our valuation position.
Is there a proposed regulation with a formula?
There is a proposed regulation that is a safe harbor for certain types of book accounting, but the safe harbor has to meet certain requirements that are consistent with the Bank One decision, that netting has to be considered, credit enhancements need to be considered. You know, it can't be a fair value determination that double counts credit risk, as Bank One did in this case. So I cannot speak to the timing on the proposed regulation.
I ask the other side, what are we supposed to do? We can go through and say, well, the netting wasn't accurate, and the bilateral credit worthiness, were you trying to balance one against the other, and it wasn't accurate in this case. But I don't know. Do we have those numbers really for us? We've got to sort that out to see whether or not it was correctly calculated?
Not the calculations. The court's determination about the correct valuation method, netting, dynamic, bilateralism, those are all fact findings. And each one of those determinations, as we set out in our brief, are clearly supported by the record. With regard to the dynamic determination, the bank's static approach violated 475's requirement that you have an annual market-to-market. What they would do is they came up with the credit risk at the inception of the swap, deferred into the future, and never revalued that credit risk again. And so their static approach ignored changes in market price, changes in counterparties' credit, also ignored early terminations. And the court's experts, the commissioner's experts, found that this type of approach is inconsistent with 475 and inconsistent with market-to-market accounting. And taxpayer complains that it would be too difficult to make this annual valuation, number one, it's required by the statute. So if he wants to complain, it should go to Congress. But in a perhaps more importantly, they did it for business purposes. They recalculated credit exposure and counterparty's credit rating for business purposes. They just didn't do it for tax purposes. So the complaint rings hollow.
Is everybody doing this right now? All the people, he said this is a ballooning industry, I guess, of swaps. So they're, what's going on out there?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm appellate counsel from the Department of Justice. I don't work for the IRS. I'm not privy to whether taxpayers are. It just hasn't come up.
You're a one case person.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we don't know what this case is going to be. What kind of precedent does this set? How does it impact all of the others that are out there now?
Well, it doesn't set out a uniform rule because every method of accounting case is fact specific, but it does provide guidance to similarly situated taxpayers. And so this would be the guidance that would apply to other taxpayers unless they can qualify for the safe harbor that's set out in the proposed reg, which is my understanding the IRS is finalizing.
You know, the proposed reg. This is this case, you know, 12, 15 years old.
I understand that.
And there's a whole lot of things that have happened since, I presume, and this is what's sort of, it's tough. I mean, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I guess we got one case and you got one case.
Right.
Can you just respond to a specific point that they made? The bank's position is that some of the requirements imposed by the tax court were not possible. For example, qualifying risk on a bilateral basis. That's one of the arguments they made. What's your response to that?
Well, the experts in this case did find that it was possible and that it was required to determine fair market value, and that with the swap, the credit exposure is bilateral. And since it had the capacity to reduce value by one party's credit rating, it had the capacity to do it for buy. I just don't remember them arguing that they didn't have the capacity. What they argued was that other dealers were not doing it, and that is irrelevant to a fair market value determination under 475 about what this dealer should be doing. And as the expert, I think it was Duffy, explained, other dealers at the time didn't have the same low credit risk rating, so it was sort of an irrelevant fact for other dealers, unlike Bank One, who I think was an A- at the time.
Well, if you're an A-, I mean, if obviously if you've got a low credit rating, the other side's taking more risk. And so does that make the swap less valuable?
It makes it more valuable to a person in the shoes of Bank One.
It's the one with the lower rating. It gets more value out of it, I guess.
That's correct. That's correct. That's as it was explained by both the commissioner's expert and the court's expert. With regard to the specific point about GAAP compliance, we said in our brief that GAAP compliance was irrelevant because, as a factual matter, the bank in this case used its unadjusted mid-market values for its fair value disclosure in its financial statements. So it doesn't help the bank to say, well, our tax value should be the same as our fair values as our fair value, because it was the unadjusted mid-market value. And in addition, Section 475 of the code requires a fair market value determination and doesn't reference GAAP. Let's see. With regard to the computations, it's our position that the tax court did not abuse its discretion because the commissioner's computations were based on the court's findings, written findings and opinion. The court explained in this case that both the improper deferral accounting as well as the improper valuation accounting had to be corrected, and to reverse the improper credit risk deferrals, the commissioner used the numbers that were set out in the court's opinion. The bank in this case is really trying to do is to re-argue a point that it already argued during the trial and lost during the trial, which was the amount for each specific year of the credit deferrals. The tax court found that the commissioner could rely on the numbers set out in the notice of the deficiency. The bank during this case tried to attack the notice of the deficiency, and the court rejected that and said, no, the notice of deficiency is not arbitrary or excessive, and the commissioner may rely on it. The taxpayer concedes on appeal it failed to prove at trial the amount of credit deferrals for 1990 to 1992, but claims in its brief, I think the word it uses, that it could sidestep that issue by looking at purported year-end balances. And that's just wrong, because the bank is ignoring the fact that it bore the burden of proof. So if it didn't prove something, you can't sidestep that, and the commissioner was entitled to rely on the notice of deficiency.
Ms. Hagley, would you, I believe in defense of the position that tax court basically accepted the IRS methodology, said it was only tweaked. Now, the IRS sought to deny the petitioner the ability to take adjustments for administrative costs and the credit risks.
Correct.
That was your position. And you had a different valuation. Now, the court didn't take that position.
That's correct. I mean,
and you would say that was simply a tweaking, the rejection of your position on that?
We said that mid-market values could be adjusted, but that the bank had not proven that they were entitled to such adjustments in this case. So the court did disagree with our conclusion
right. That
the result should be mid-market without adjustments. But I would point out, if you look at the results of the computation, applying the method espoused by the court, the result is pretty close to mid-market value. 4 years of swaps, the bank was only entitled to reduce credit risk adjustments on about 30 different swaps. And with regard to that, the bank mentioned the issue about the 59 swaps versus the 30 swaps. They didn't challenge that on appeal. That was something they fought about below, but that's not part of what their appeal. On appeal, with regard to the computation, it's limited to the reversal of the credit risk deferral.
If one were not to take the view that it was tweaked, but that was a different third way,
mm-hmm.
What's your best argument that the tax court could do that?
Our best argument is that this is a specific method of accounting and that the court has the power to interpret it, and I would urge you to look at the consolidated manufacturing case because, in fact, that's what the court did there. So, unless the court has any further questions?
I guess not.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Hagley.
Thank you.
Mr. Schiffman.
This is not a case where the tax court tweaked the government's method of accounting. Let me talk about the administrative cost adjustment, which is actually where more dollars are located. The government's position was that you cannot have an administrative cost adjustment unless you can look at market data, market pricing data, which says how the market prices administrative costs. And then in a catch-22, the government said, but there is no market data, so you don't get any administrative adjustment. Period. We advocated an administrative cost adjustment. We computed it. We sometimes called it the fully allocated cost method. The court said, no, it should be marginal cost, not fully allocated cost. Now we've quarreled with that decision, but there's no way that marginal costs represent a tweaking of zero costs, which was what the government's position was. Now, during the course of the trial, one of the criticisms that we kept raising against the government was, look, all you've done is complain that we didn't use a perfect method. How would you do it? You said you've got to do it bilateral. You've got to take into account netting. Actually, give us a computation and show what your actual number is. And what the government said in its post-trial brief was, respondent did present an alternative valuation, unadjusted mid-market values, values which would clearly reflect its swap income. Unadjusted values are closer to fair market value than adjusted values and thus should be used for accounting. And the judge clearly understood that their method was no adjustments at all. And the judge never said or hinted or suggested in any way, shape, or form that he was tweaking their method. He was going in a different direction. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schiffman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.